Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Dana Fredsty, who is the author of the Ashley Parker series. And she had mentioned that it was kind of a Buffy meets The Walking Dead, and we're going to get to talk about that in a minute. I just want to go to you right away and ask you about you, because we don't really know each other. We met once.
At dinner, yes, many years ago.
And Dana married a man who has been a good friend of mine for a long time, and you have heard him, David Fitzgerald, which is not relevant to today at all. So let's go to you and ask you however you want to talk about you. What's most important to you when you think back on your life?
When I think back on my life, I think the most important thing, animal rescue is probably animal rescue, riding, sword fighting.
Oh, fencing. I did that too.
Mine was theatrical combat. I actually trained in theatrical combat since I was 18.
Okay, stop. Hold your horses. How did you get to that? Because I was told also that you were a stunt woman for movies. Can you talk about that whole life?
The stunts that I did mainly were fighting, you know, fight doubling and like the movie Army of Darkness, which is the third in the Evil Dead series.
How long ago was that?
That was 90, I'm going to creep for just a second here.
Yeah.
That was, that was.
But not when you were a child. I mean, you were.
No, I was in my late 20s, early 30s.
What made you go for this?
When I was 18, I was doing a Renaissance fair, my very first one in San Diego, back when we had it at the Oregon Pavilion. I was standing in line waiting to get a turkey leg, because that's what you did.
Yeah.
And this cute guy in a white shirt with the big flowy sleeves and breeches and boots was talking to his friend, and he was bitching about his fight partner had dropped out at the last minute. So he didn't get to, you know, he wasn't going to get to perform his street fight. And I just...
And the street fight was fisticuffs or swords?
Swords.
Because he was dressed like a swashbuckler, I'm guessing.
Just kind because of. That's what... I'll get to that.
Okay.
I basically piped up and said, I'll do it. He turned around, looked at me, and I was very cute back then, and he went, okay, and I actually...
Excuse me, for all of you who cannot see her, she's very cute now. Go ahead. That's why I need a television moment.
So this was Chris Villa, and he was a theatrical combat instructor and choreographer.
How interesting.
And I actually was engaged to him for a while.
Oh.
It was my first experience.
Wait, so what was that first fight? It was with swords?
Short swords.
Yes.
And it was sort of like a cross between a knife and a sword fight, and I learned the moves in an hour, and we performed it.
Okay, so I was going to ask you that, because that came so naturally to you that you could do it without any training.
Yeah.
Were you wearing? I'm just curious.
I was wearing a big red skirt and a cinch belt and a white blouse. My character was a gypsy.
So you were costumed enough to have it work.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so what happened? What came next?
I studied with Chris and did some work as his assistant, and then I worked with a couple of other people and eventually started training with Dan Speaker and Jan Bryant at the Academy of Theatrical Combat in L.A.
I never knew there was such a thing, and I'm from there, and I thought I knew a whole bunch.
Yeah.
What is that exactly? I mean, how does...
It's where you learn all different styles of
And that just grew on
fighting.
Its own as a special need for the movie industry?
Yeah, before stuntmen... there's always been choreographers like Bob Anderson, who did a lot of the fights that you've seen, Princess Bride, and my brain is just totally spacing
of the names. It's just the concept is so interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's a huge... I mean, back when we started doing it, I actually, before I started training with them, I did sword fighting at Renaissance fairs with some other people that had also been trained. And so we had like an anachronistic group or duo, Rose and Rapier. This was my ex-husband.
Mm-hmm.
He and I did this.
So
like sword fighting with comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was back when very few people did it. And now basically you can throw a rock at a Renaissance fair and you'll hit a swordsman or a swordswoman in the head. There's just a lot more of it now, but yeah, it's a specialized thing.
When I heard stunt, of course I pictured, you know, coming out of flaming cars.
No lighting myself on fire, no high falls, but, you know, doing fights, taking falls, but not heights
crippling
in the air,
yes,
not friends.
Right, yes.
And I did the Conan show briefly at Universal Studios, and I had to rappel down a 30-foot drop, and that was enough for the height thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how did that come to a close, and you moved to San Francisco?
Yeah, what happened is I ended up needing a big change in my life. My ex and I separated, mm-hmm. and I decided to either move back to San Diego or up here. And San Diego is my old hometown, but it felt like childhood. Yeah, so I decided to move up here and see what happened.
So you came up here and you didn't know anybody and you just started.
I knew. Like,
that's always such a brave thing to do.
I knew Dave.
Oh, you did?
I did know Dave. Yeah, we had not started dating. We started dating when I moved up here.
How did you meet him?
I met him through sword fighting.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. We had friends that did what's called LARPing, live gaming, live action role-playing gaming, mm-hmm. where you get costumes and characters and stuff like that.
So it was a natural.
It was a natural thing. And he and I are both big geeks from way back when. And he was into fencing and I was into sword fighting. And I showed him choreography that I'd done at the Conan show after one of the games. We flirted a little bit, but we were both married to other people and happily.
Oh, yeah.
And then we met again 10 years later. And
how nice.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your writing. How did you move into that?
I have been writing since I was old enough to string words together.
Oh,
it's one of the things.
So it's not something new.
No, I've always wanted to do it. I've always done it. I had a murder mystery theatrical troupe with my best friend in San Diego.
Oh.
We wrote the scripts for it. She and I wrote a murder mystery together because we wanted to kill someone we worked with. And that ended up being my first published novel because I ended up rewriting it.
How long ago was that?
My first novel was published 2007. The original draft was written back in the mists of time. I don't remember how old we were. We wrote it very quickly and we were hopped up on chocolate chip cookies and white Zinfandel. So the first draft was, needed a lot of work, but it was fun. So.
And so tell us now about your Ashley Parker series.
How many
books are there and what are those themes and why are those important to you?
There's three books, mm-hmm. Plague Town, Plague Nation, Plague World. And I was asked to write a series basically that was like Buffy, but with zombies instead of vampires, but different.
Okay, so would you like to define the difference between zombies and vampires?
Well, vampires are bloodsuckers and generally can be sexy.
Mm-hmm.
If you see the Dracula movies, there's always a lot of the sexual nature of vampires and the seduction. Zombies, at least the way that I think of them, there's nothing sexy about them.
They're just walking dead.
They're dead, reanimated corpses that come back with a craving for human flesh. And people have taken them in other directions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really delightful movie called Warm Bodies, which I call a zombie fairy tale, which is just a really beautiful movie.
There are a lot of beautiful stories that Hollywood has kind of mushed up. I mean, well, Dracula is a fabulous mystery.
Right.
I mean, that is just exquisite. And the whole Frankenstein business, which you see repeated in literature, I mean, the monster who's created and is lonely.
Right. And who's the monster, him or the creator, basically, is how
well, he's definitely not, I don't think.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is. I mean, people do what they think they can do.
Right. Zombies are monsters.
Zombies are monsters, but through their own fault?
No, they're just, they're reanimated through, depending on which writer, there's many different ways that they can be reanimated now. Back then, George Romero was basically the father of the flesh-eating ghoul zombie, as opposed to the voodoo zombie.
Oh, okay, what's the difference there? One has magic qualities?
The voodoo, basically, they are people who are brought back by a sorcerer.
That's what I mean by magic.
Yeah, and they can be dispersed with salt in their food.
Oh.
And sent back. They don't eat human flesh.
Uh-huh.
Like movie The White Zombie with Bela Lugosi. That's that kind of zombie.
Mm-hmm.
George Romero did a movie called Night of the Living Dead, and it was originally named Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically a satellite. We think this is what goes on. They never really say, but essentially a satellite blows up and the satellite sends radiation down.
Oh.
And the corpses of the recently dead animate and they eat the living. And it was just a really simple idea that there's something really scary to me about someone that looks like someone you love,
mm-hmm.
but they're not inside anymore.
Oh, Body Snatchers, The Invasion of the Body. That was a terrifying movie.
Yeah.
That original one?
Yeah. Yeah. Same kind of thing.
Yes.
So for me, I always had nightmares where my parents were there, but they weren't my parents. And I think that's one of the reasons that I think that zombies are so creepy, is that sense of...
Well, but also that all this kind of being hooked into this came to you for a reason, kind of naturally. by your fear? How old were you when you first?
I first saw Night of the Living Dead when
I was
in
high
school.
When you first thought your parents, maybe not your parents, when you first had that concept.
Oh gosh, I remember having those dreams back. I mean, as long as I've dreamed.
Yeah.
That goes back way, 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 way.
So I wonder how connected you're talking about, you know, the radiation comes down mm-hmm. and the dead come back to life. Mm-hmm. I wonder how historically and just how far that goes back and how related that is to the whole idea of reincarnation. And
I don't know. I mean, there's...
In really early societies.
There's been... Every society, every country has their own version of the vampire legend, the shapeshifter, and a lot of them also have flesh-eating dead. I mean, it goes back as far as...
But what do you think that is?
It's creepy. I don't know. It's creepy.
It must serve something. Okay, so go back to...
Know.
Okay, the flesh-eating dead, and the zombies are...
Are
just pure evil and not sexy.
They're not even evil. They're just, they are what they are and they're unstoppable, you know, in terms of you can run as fast as you want and they'll shamble after you, but they won't stop basically until, you know, if they know that there's food there, they're going to go for it. And there's something about implacable. Like what kind?
Like all creatures.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Now what about vampires? Because, you know, I read that whole Anne Rice series.
Oh yeah.
And it was the first time I had ever been so sympathetic. These people didn't ask to be this, these creatures.
That depends on the writer's take on them. A lot of them are just, like in the Buffy universe, they're, when you're bitten by a vampire, a demon takes, your soul is kicked out, and there's a demon inside of you, and they are evil, and they revel.
No, I understand
in
that,
evil,
but they didn't have to be bitten.
No, that's true.
So at some level, they're always victims.
Well, in some of the stories and some of the movies, they want it. They want
that's
the
what
eternal
I'm asking.
Life.
Is it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So. So
eternal life.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So go ahead about your stories. What was your first one centered on?
The first one was centered on the outbreak and my heroine, who's a 29-year-old student at a college amongst a bunch of younger students. Her professor husband dumped her for a model 10 years younger, the younger model, basically. Mm-hmm. And so she's trying to go back to college and find herself. And she finds herself in the middle of a zombie attack with her boyfriend. She's bitten. And normally when you're bitten by a zombie, that's it. It's 100% fatal. You die, you come back. She's part of a very small percentage of the population that's what I call wild cards, in that if they survive the fever, if they don't get torn to pieces and eaten, they come back and they are now immune and their senses are enhanced. It's not like they're X-Men. They're not, you know, superheroes, but they're stronger. Their sense of smell, taste, everything is better. Their reflexes. So
how did she use hers?
She becomes a small group of wild cards connected to this super duper duper secret government organization that's basically been around for centuries, called the DZN. And that's actually short for, I can't even pronounce it. It's terrible. It's my own book and the name of this organization. I did my own audiobooks and I couldn't pronounce it.
Did you make up the name?
I actually had a friend who was a linguistic and a history major come up with a name that basically means killers of the dead.
Uh-huh.
Dolophone Necros something something. It's
okay.
I really should have had it written down.
That's okay. You've got the necro part, so
yes.
We know what you're talking about. Okay.
So the first book is them trying to stop it, the plague from spreading. They have it isolated in this small area around a mountain town. And so
now,
that's
is your second book connected? I mean, is it sequential? Is it like a series? Or are they in? Okay, so what happens next?
The next book is Plague Nation. Mm-hmm. And as a friend of mine said, the back of the first book is, will they succeed in stopping the plague? Coming soon, Plague Nation. Well, obviously, they did not succeed. They succeeded on a small level, but the plague spreads. The third book is Plague World, and it goes airborne. So it's basically them trying to find the cure, them, you know.
How does it go airborne?
It mutates.
Okay.
Very, you know.
Okay.
Simply.
So go ahead, Wood.
I'm trying to think of where I was.
You were, it goes airborne.
Oh, yeah, it goes airborne. So basically, the three books, it's this group of wild cards and what they're doing to try to stop it. There's also a shadow organization that's trying to spread it. So it's, you know, some good versus evil. You know, there's a mystery reveal. And I have fun playing first in a small town that's sort of like a ripoff of Humboldt. And then the next book I show it happening over the nation, and part of it takes place in San Francisco. And the third book, we start in San Francisco, and then I've got interludes around the world, and then I've also got action set in San Diego, which is my hometown. So I like to set things in places I've been.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's a little more realistic.
Well, I think people also like that. I do. I like a real location.
Yeah.
When I watch a movie, I want to know what city it is. Some of the old movies, you know, the noir films. I always ask, you know, what town are they in?
Yeah.
Somehow location is an intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really
true.
That
makes you feel part of the story, at least.
Well, I know I like reading books by authors when they're setting it in a small town that you can tell it's obviously, if it's not real, it's based on something real.
Oh, I was going to say, it feels real.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
I mean, Shadow of a Doubt in Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
So familiar. So what is it that this is, I don't know if this is even a fair question or something you could answer, but like, what is this do for you? What does this mean to you? I mean, I'm listening to you talk, and I can see that you're dealing with some issues that are just so basic.
Well, it's one of, I've just always...
Fear of death.
Fear of...
And worse, fear of not even being able to be peaceful in that.
It's not even that part. It's to me, there's something really horrifying about being eaten alive. I mean, I've always been fascinated by, you know, crocodiles, alligators, like that, sharks. I've always read about, you know, shark attacks and stuff. And
yes,
it's funny because I've worked with big cats, but I never had the same visceral fear of being...
Wait a minute. So hold your horses again. When did you do that? Was that part of...
Oh, that was a large...
When you say big cats, you mean tigers and lions?
Yeah, jaguars and stuff like that. There's a feline, exotic feline breeding facility / feline conservation center down in Rosamond, California. I volunteered there for over 10 years and I still go down
goodness.
To NC.
Uh-huh.
And you work in close contact with a lot of these animals.
And you didn't have that fear then?
No, maybe it's because they're cute and fuzzy, and if I'm going to be ripped to pieces, I'd rather
be
by a cute and fuzzy, you know. There's something about crocodiles are so
heartless.
And they're dinosaurs left over to me.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
So,
well, they are.
Yeah.
I felt that way about birds also. I remember saying to my children once,
yeah,
they're dinosaurs.
Yep,
and,
raptors.
Oh, they laughed, and, you know, how goofy was I. But
I also totally agree.
That I think one of the worst scenes, I mean, I am so with you here, one of the worst scenes in Jurassic Park was how the velociraptors attacked.
Yeah.
Do you want to... Would you like the pleasure of explaining that, if you remember?
They hunted
they take
a pack. Oh, their claws, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Oh,
Yeah, we're doing this.
Evisceration.
Evisceration with those three miserable claws. And then they start dining on you while you're still alive.
Ugh. See, and that's the thing about zombies. The Dawn of the Dead, the second movie George Romero did, there's a classic scene there where they show someone get taken down alive, his stomach is pulled open, and I call it the intestinal taffy pull because now every movie does it, and it's almost, you know, I make fun of it now.
That's like an instant cure for appetite, that sentence alone.
You want to know what's really sad?
Yes.
I can watch almost any zombie movie, no matter how gory it is. And
I can have a cheeseburger?
Oh, I can eat spaghetti while I'm watching it with red sauce. It's just like, it does not bother me to watch it.
Because it's two different things.
Yeah. Dawn of the Dead was my first date movie. So maybe that's part of it. I associate zombies with getting popcorn and soda bought for me.
Okay. Nice snacks.
Yeah. But yeah, there's just something really horrifying about that. Vampires, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about them. You say that they're sexy in a way that...
Yeah.
And that's because of the way they're defined or because of what moviedom has done with them?
I think both. I mean, Dracula, as Bram Stoker wrote, except he kept talking about Dracula's bad breath, but there is a sexual element to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have movies like 30 Days of Night.
Well, even Coming in the Windows, it was so Romeo and Juliet in a way.
Yeah. So that's just that's that take on it. Then there was Nosferatu, who was just a monster, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the 30 Days of Night type vampires, and they're horrific, and they just revel in killing, and they have no sympathy. You know, it just depends. Like the Anne Rice vampires, they're torn between two worlds. There's a sympathy element.
Yes.
So it really just
depends. That little girl, Charlotte, who was made a vampire when she was
Claudia.
Like a Claudia?
Yeah.
When it was
Claudia.
A C name. Claudia.
Yeah.
And it was, she was in such despair that she hadn't gotten to live her life yet.
Yeah.
That she was trapped forever as a, three-year-old, seven, whatever it was.
I think she was five.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
And that she was aware that she was stuck in that prison of its own.
Yeah. They had, did that too with a movie called Near Dark, which it was directed by Catherine Bigelow, and it had a lot of the actors that you would see in Aliens, James Cameron, his stable of actors, and it was really good. It was basically redneck vampires, and one of them was from the Civil War, one of them was a little kid, same thing, who was like really...
So it really permeates all of... So it's got to be speaking to something important.
I think people like the idea, well, goths, you know, the whole dark and decadent and everything is doom and gloom and I'm going to wear black and paint my face white. And vampires appeal to that because they're creatures of the night, you know, and they're loners and they have to survive on blood, but yet they're still sexy. There's just all of these like buttons that they hit, the romance and,
oh, and
the darkness.
Oh, and by the way, wait, just to ask you, because you'll know about this, there is some condition. Would you please...
I don't remember what it's called, but it's something where people actually do crave human blood.
Oh, well, that's not a pretty thing. Yes, I would guess that. I never heard of that. But a condition where people actually they can't really function in daylight because the sunlight is so...
Sun allergy. I can't remember what that's called either.
And they really are very pale.
Yeah.
So they kind of function by night.
Yeah.
And I would guess that in some societies, if you see one of those walking down the street, because there aren't a whole lot, so it's kind of a loner...
And they were probably killed, you know. I'm sure in a really superstitious societies that someone like that, if that particular stereotype fits in with that society's particular vampire legend, that, you know, if you get a lot of superstitious people, a lot of people, you know, with that condition probably didn't make it very far.
And seeing somebody walk, you know, kind of silently down the street alone in the dark. Today we might say, are you okay?
Yeah.
And want to know if there's something wrong, but sure.
Or think they were a goth. So
that too. All of this seems to come so naturally as you're talking about it.
I've been interested in this stuff since I was really little. When I was a kid, I would go to the library and, you know, I tore through the children's section too, but I would go to the nonfiction section and the adult section and try to find anything on vampires, on werewolves. My book collection, my ex and I had a huge supernatural occult book collection. You know, it was great research for writers, but I was just very, very interested in this stuff. Always very, I was a really morbid kid. Very, very, very morbid. And I've always been fascinated by monsters and I liked being scared.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's interesting because I was going to say, I wouldn't call that morbid really, if you look at it kind of gently. I mean, to have a fascination with something that can reflect a fear or an awareness of something in this, you know, world, I don't really think that's morbid, but I like being scared. What did that serve?
I have no idea. I've always loved horror movies. And
but you like being scared, and you were scared, but you knew it wasn't really a threat, or what?
I think so. You know, it's been a long time since... I mean, I still enjoy a movie that can actually scare me. There's just The last movie I saw that made me actually switch the lights on when I went upstairs into the bathroom was the American version of The Grudge with Sarah Michelle Gellar. It's one of those, it's a Japanese horror movie, and Japanese just, their ghosts are mean, nasty-ass mofos. They are just vengeful, nasty.
And that got you.
Yeah, and there was just some stuff in this movie that was really creepy. There were scenes that I found really, really, like, I remembered them, and in the middle of the night, I'm going up there kind of going, click, light goes on, and that very rarely happens anymore.
I can imagine that it doesn't, the older you get and the kind of more in charge you are of this, that it wouldn't be as scary. But I had an experience recently that surprised me, and now that I'm talking to you, I feel better.
Oh, good.
Late night television, and I switched on the Alfred Hitchcock Hour.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that was from the early 60s.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it as a kid, and I had to turn it off. I was so terrified by whatever episode it was.
Oh, wow.
And they weren't monsters. They were just regular guys in suits.
But it was creepy.
So, yes, there's something about just unbridled evil.
Yeah.
When you can feel it, you feel unprotected, even if it's on a screen that you can...
Yeah. Did you ever see The Legend... The Haunting of Hill House, made from the Shirley Jackson novel?
No, but I know the title. What is it?
They did a remake, and the remake we just pretend never happened because it was all about special effects and it was horrible and it shouldn't have been. The original had Julie Harris and Russ Tamblyn and Claire Bloom and I can't remember, Richard, first name was Richard, a British actor.
Attenberg? Attenborough?
No,
oh, I don't
different
know.
One. Okay. Yeah. There was no blood, and this is one of the creepiest movies I've ever seen.
Say
in my
the title
life.
Again so we can.
Haunting of Hill House.
Okay, I'm going to get that.
Not to be confused with The Legend of Hell House, yeah. Which was a Richard Matheson book that okay. also got turned into a movie.
So. Yes, there's a lot of mysterious, scary possibilities in the world. Yeah. I guess that's what makes them scary, is their possibilities.
It's both enchanting. It's like people who want to believe in Narnia or anything else, or the world of the Fae. It's just like, we all want to think there's something
else out
there. Oh,
look at that Slender Man.
The Slender Man?
Slender Man. Oh, you could look that up later.
Okay.
That's a hideous thing. That led those two girls to murder their friend in the woods.
Oh, because they thought that...
Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah.
So these things, you know, the reality line gets kind of blurred. Let me ask you something. If you were to write a love letter right now, to whom would it be? And just fly free. Do you write letters? I mean, you are a writer, but maybe you do or don't.
I used to all of the time.
Do you have any letters that were written to you? Do you still have them?
I do. Actually, my ex wrote me very few letters, but the ones that he did, I treasure and I've kept.
Oh, nice.
And Dave has written me some absolutely wonderful, amazing letters, you know, and he's a big, very, very romantic Valentine's Day,
yes.
You know, the kind of sentiment that my sarcastic family didn't really have. You know, it's funny, my stepdad is the same way. He's very romantic and writes this stuff for my mom, and Dave is very much like that.
And so look how you're smiling. See, people, this is why I need television, because you're smiling equally at the really sweetly romantic, unbridled romantic, and unbridled horror. So that's nice that your life allows both to come in. So
it's a good balance.
Yes, it's a good balance.
Yeah.
Who would you write a love letter to?
I would write a love letter to Dave, I think.
Okay.
You know,
yes.
I, it's...
Have you ever?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So that counts.
I've written some... He saves all the cards that I give him, too.
By the way, can I just say, because I tend to look at the historical and I look far down the line. And as a writer, you and David, and you're both doing kind of significant things... That, I mean, you're authors, and when people find the letters generations from now, they're going to know something really more about you, the writer of this series.
Right.
And the woman who is really, I don't want to say obsessed, that's not a fair word, but gripped by the horror. And David, who is just gripped by telling the truth.
Right, right.
It'll be interesting for people down the line to find these letters.
Yeah. We should write
and know more about, well, even the ones you have.
Yeah.
You know, to see another side of you.
I think it's email. I miss letters written down on paper,
sure.
Which is why I like cards, because emails, you can print them out and save them, and we have and everything, but it's just not the same.
Oh, from each other?
Yeah.
Do you ask him to sign them once you print them out?
Never done that.
Oh, you
never
should.
Thought of it, you know?
Because there's something about handwriting that carries a lot. Talk about mysteries.
Yeah.
Handwriting is just a mystery goo area.
I can't read mine. It's terrible.
Well, but it doesn't matter. It's still yours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sometimes, you know, more reliable than a thumbprint.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay. So signing them, because when you get an email, where's the gift really? It's in the sentiment, but you've got to do a lot of work. You got to load the thing. You got to download it. You've got to print it.
Right.
It's different than getting something in the mail.
Yeah.
That comes like a beautiful emerald on your mail pile.
I'm glad that I remember that, you know, that I was born still before email, before computers,
yes.
And so pen pals and all of that,
yes.
Were very much a part of my life.
So that was wonderful. One other thing about writing letters is, I forgot what I was going to say, something about, yes, well...
Writing a love letter to the motorcycle outside and telling them to stop.
Exactly. Writing a love letter to some of these characters.
Oh, I
see. Just think that would be such a fun thing to do.
A lot of people do that kind of thing as writing exercises, too.
Yes.
You know, to
but
get into
actual
the
love
heads.
Letters. You know, Dear Bram, or Dear Dracula, or Dear, you know, Mary Shelley. Oh, I think those would be delicious. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for doing this.
Oh, I've enjoyed myself. Thank you for having me.
I've learned so much about things I never knew, like the, you know, training studios. What did you...
The Academy of Theatrical Combat.
Academy of Three... Yes. Never knew such a thing existed.
Oh, yeah.
And then you talked about another... I feel more educated. Thank you, dear.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Well, until next time, this is Janet Gowan saying goodbye. And to remind you again that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, There's always someone or some special occasion or someone fictional or someone gone. And those can be delicious love letters. We had one guest, I'll just tell you, Alicia Escott, who wrote a series of love letters to extinct species.
Oh, I love that.
Uh-huh. You would.
Yeah.
And they are the steamiest love letters to extinct. There was one to an extinct dinosaur. It's just exquisite.
Are they published anywhere? Or?
I'll send you. I'll send
Please
it
do.
To
I'd
you.
I'd love
yeah.
to see that.
Anyway, so all of those things are just wonderful. Thank you, dear. Bye for now. See you next to see you. Talk to you later, everybody.